Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Englewood, New Jersey, and earned a bachelor's degree in economics from Michigan State University. During a 40-year career with Universal Forex Products Company, he rose from a junior salesman to CEO and owner. From 1989 to 1993, he was the U.S. ambassador to Italy. A legendary Grand Rapids businessman, lumber magnate, philanthropist, cheerleader, his name, Peter Secchia. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the former ambassador to Italy, Peter Secchia. Peter, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Well, my mom and my dad were very hardworking people. My dad was the son of immigrants, and his father worked 37 years without missing a day of work, 7 days a week. He worked five nights a week at the local Italian-American club in Tenafly, New Jersey, and he has spent the other 2 days a week as a bartender and a coffee maker in roasting his beans in the garage and making his own coffee packages. My mother worked at the local high school, and she was an entry-level worker who worked very hard but only worked 4 days, 5 days a week. And then later on, when they finally had a few bucks in the bank, they bought a small candy store, and the whole family worked there part-time, and we tried to struggle through the Second World War as an Italian-American family with experience of a lot of ill feelings and prejudice, but we got through it, and we know how others feel when they have the same issue, and that's probably why my wife and I have worked so hard with inner-city kids and public schools, and from Baxter Center to Youth Commonwealth to the various police organizations that work with kids. It's been a great ride, and I've enjoyed it. My mom passed away just a summer and a half ago, and she moved back here and lived at Covenant Village, and my father died at age 64 from a heart attack about 1 month after he'd retired. And his retirement came at age 63, and at age 64 he was gone. So I never got to spend too much time with him, and he never got to visit with me during my more successful years, because when he left I was still struggling trying to pay the bills and make the mortgage payments and do whatever a hardworking young father of four has to do. So I miss him and I miss my mom, but I've met a lot of wonderful people along the way.
Growing up in New Jersey, Peter, how was it you ever got to Michigan State University?
Well, when we were in high school, I was fortunate enough to live in a small town that bused its students to Tenafly High School. And at Tenafly High School, about 90% of the kids went on to college, but they went to Eastern schools and Ivy League schools that were quite expensive. And it became obvious to me that if I didn't read the magazines and pretend I was looking for a school, I was not part of the in crowd. And I found Michigan State University, which was, I believe, $115 a quarter for tuition and guaranteed you a part-time job. So I told my folks I was going to college, and they weren't so sure that was the right thing for me to do. Off we went one Sunday night, and I remember it very well because my father was watching the Ed Sullivan Show, and we had to wait until the commercial break before he'd come out and say goodbye. And I remember the words he used. He said, "You'll be home in 6 months." And in the winter quarter, back then Michigan State was on quarters, not semesters, I received a telegram from the congressman who had appointed me to the military academy that they were opening an Air Force academy in Colorado, and I would be his principal appointee if I wanted it. Well, of course, I jumped for joy and told him I'd love to have it. I was running out of money at Michigan State, wasn't earning enough to fund all my expenses, and also was a little bit on the weak side when it came to trying to date the pretty girls at Michigan State and buy an occasional beer or pizza. So I wanted a place to go where I wouldn't have to pay. I was looking for a free ride. And so he appointed me, and off I went to Selfridge Air Force Base to take tests. Did well in the test, excelled in the athletic portion of the test, and was elected head of the Midwest appointees for the first class ever at the Air Force Academy. However, that's the good news. The bad news is, in May of 1956, I received another telegram from the same congressman telling me that the results of my physical showed that my eyes were uncorrectable to 20/20 vision. I had never been to an eye doctor in my life. That was something that only the more affluent families did back in those days. And we had nurses came to the school, and you had a pass or a fail. And I had passed, but turned out that my eyes had a reverse astigmatism and that it was not correctable. And therefore, the Air Force Academy didn't want me. And when I investigated why, I found out that the first class was supposed to be for F-16 pilots. Even though the F-16 hadn't been built, they were designing that first class to be a talented bunch of people who could see a lot better than I could, and therefore there was no room for me. And then the results of that were, in the excitement to go to the Air Force Academy, the overwhelming attraction to all the beautiful people in East Lansing led me to end up with a bad series of grades and a letter to my mom and dad telling me that I would be asked to stay home in the spring quarter and that there was nothing for me. So I took a job with the American Red Cross in Lansing and drove a blood mobile for the months of May and June, and then stepped on a broken beer bottle in Houghton Lake on Memorial Day weekend and never really recovered from that, and went back home and joined the United States Marine Corps only because I didn't have any other options. Next thing I know, I'm in Grand Rapids working for Universal Forest Products, and I never left.
We're talking to Peter Secchia, who met a man that changed his life. When we come back, we'll ask him about that. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Peter Secchia, who met a man named William F. Grant, and it changed his life. Peter, tell us about that event.
Well, Mr. Grant used to come to Michigan State University with his son, Bill Grant Jr., and Bill had been in two or three different colleges and had really not found his place in life yet and was a young guy trying to party a little bit too much, and Big Bill, as we used to affectionately call Mr. Grant, recognized that I had an influence on Bill Jr., and he wanted me to come to work for him because someday he wanted Bill Jr. to come to work in the same company. But I wasn't interested because I had been given a pretty good job offer from Chrysler Corporation to go into their management program and to get a master's degree and probably try to go for an MBA with the support of the Chrysler Corporation. But it's ironic, the kids today wouldn't understand this, but back in those days, you couldn't get a good job in December when you graduated off term. Most of the schools fed into a training program at various corporations, which always started in June, after the May and June graduations. So if you graduated off term, you really had a void in your life because you had nothing to do between December and June. And that's what happened to me. And Mr. Grant had just invested with several other West Michigan friends in a small lumber stud mill up in British Columbia, Prince George. So he asked me if I'd go to work for him up there to learn the business, plus to present myself as a trainee who was learning the business, but who would keep my eye on his investment. And that was a problem because he was down here in Grand Rapids and his investment was in Prince George, British Columbia. And that was a long ways away. So I agreed to do that at the big sum of $600 per month. And I graduated in December, and I got my first paycheck in advance, and I spent $100 on me, and I spent the other $500 on my parents and got them the first rug they ever had for their dining room and the first TV set my father ever had in 1962 that wasn't homemade. My uncle, who had been a radio man in the Navy, had built our first two television sets with cathode ray tubes and knobs and giant tubes that I'd never seen since. And it was fun to be able to do something for my parents, and I went off to Grand Rapids, Michigan on the 26th of December in 1962. And we flew into the old airport out on 44th Street, wooden building, and now the Steelcase campus, I believe. But anyway, I came to the office, and he gave me a couple of days of training, and off I went right after that, and landed in Vancouver, and had to overnight to catch a flight up to Prince George, British Columbia. And it was a beautiful day, and I rented a car, and I had a new suit and a vest and a new top coat and a hat. I thought I was on a briefcase. I thought I was cool. I was a new graduate. I spent the night there and went around town and looked at Vancouver and caught a plane the next morning, landed in Prince George, British Columbia. So I spent a lot of my nights reading and writing letters to friends of mine back at Michigan State University. And when I left, I came back in the spring and was going to go on to Chrysler. But I was beginning to find a little bit of a love for the forest products industry. And so I decided that I'd stay another year and test it out and see if I learned anything and could do anything with it. So Mr. Grant agreed to let me stay another year, and then Chrysler agreed to postpone my starting in the management program. So I spent a year on the road trying to sell lumber, and I didn't do very good. Finally, I got a few accounts and saw that maybe I could make a little more per month than my monthly draw, which was in the negative every month because I just wasn't earning enough on a commission basis to cover my draw. And then the second year started, and I was into 1964 and planned to get married to Joan in that June. So we took a risk, and she took a school teaching job up in Rockford, and she later was teaching school in East Grand Rapids. And she was making $4,300 a month, and I was now up to maybe $700 a month, $800 a month. And we took an apartment on Houseman, and we worked long days, and we worked hard, and business came together. I finally started to get a few orders. I made some friends in the business, and things went wonderful from that point on. I loved it, and I stayed there for 40 years. In 1968, I had a chance to buy into the company, and I bought 10% of a very small company, but I bought it over time. And then in 1971, Mr. Grant decided to retire, and he sold me 51% of the company, and from that point on, we started to hire executives. We had 7 employees when I joined, when I bought the company, or the majority of the company, and we had 10,500 when I retired in 2003, which was the result of a lot of hard work by other persons, not just me. But I went off to Rome, and Mr. Curry, Bill Curry, ran the company, and he took it from several hundred to several thousand, and it just grew from there. And now it's one of the best managed and best run companies that I know of in West Michigan.
You mentioned, Peter, ambassador to Italy from 89 to 93. What does an ambassador do?
Well, it depends on where you get assigned. If you go to Egypt, you spend a lot of time working in international aid and how to use American foreign aid to buy equipment, help farmers, to help poor people, to run education programs. If you go to an industrialized country like Italy, they have their own education systems and they have their own farm programs, and they don't need the Peace Corps, and they don't want the Peace Corps, but they want a friend. And because Italy was one of the weaker countries at the time in Europe, they loved having the United States as their friend and partner. Each embassy has a different role to play and a different function.
We're talking to Peter Secchia. When we come back, we'll ask him about the time he spent with Pope John Paul II the Great. And I'm Jack Crystal, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Crystal, and we're with Peter Secchia. Peter, tell us about one or two of the times that you spent with the Pope, John Paul II the Great.
Well, my wife, being an avid Catholic, and her parents were visiting us in Rome, and I arranged for us to see the Pope, and it was a wonderful experience for them, and it was a wonderful experience for me. The second time we met with him was under different circumstances. And I was at his midnight mass during the capture of Noriega in the Panama Nuncio. The Nuncio is where the Vatican representative lives. And the Papal Nuncio was hosting Noriega at his home when we surrounded it. So there were various circumstances. And my wife was thrilled and we still have pictures all over the various family locations with her parents and enjoying their time with Pope.
You mentioned Gerald Ford. You were very, very close. Tell us about President Gerald Ford.
What a special guy. I just this morning was working on a legacy issue for him. You know, most people don't realize it, but he was the one who ended the Vietnam War in April of 1975 when he declared that the war was over after Congress had refused to fund what he was looking for. But he never forgot the Vietnamese and the people we had to bring home and the friends of our country. Gerry Ford was a compassionate man. He was an administrative genius. He was always cast as a bit of a bumbler, but yet the truth were to be known, he was probably the finest athlete we ever had in that position. He was a great athlete and had been a boxing coach at Yale. He'd been a football player at Michigan. He was able to do most things that people wouldn't think of doing at his age. And besides his ability to work with others. He played golf with Tip O'Neill in the morning and debate with him in the afternoon. Tip O'Neill was one of his closest friends. He knew how to work with people. He knew how to make compromise and to make things happen. He'll go down in history as one of the greats, and even though he only had 26 short months in the White House, he made an impact. And I love him and miss him dearly.
President Ronald Reagan. Tell us about Reagan.
Well, I didn't get to spend much time with Reagan. I worked with his staff because I was a younger political activist. After Ford left, and Reagan had been his antagonist in the 76 campaign, I really had no opportunity to endear myself close to those who were around Reagan. So they had been with him through the campaign, and I had been with Ford. So it took a while for those wounds to heal, and many of those who served with Reagan I now see on a regular basis, but they're getting aged, and things change over the years, and I think Jerry Ford and Reagan became very good friends, and we end up with everybody coming together, as time has a way of doing.
Talk to us about the man that made you the ambassador to Italy, President George H. Bush.
Well, as a young political activist, you know, everybody asked me how you get to become an ambassador. I had no intention of that. I worked with him. I helped him. I put out lawn signs for him. I raised funds for him. I ran dinners for him. I arranged for meetings for him. I spoke and organized at panels for him. And somehow or other, we became friends. And Jim Baker had worked with Ford in the 76 campaign. And when Gerald R. Ford wanted a friend in Washington, and he was out in California, Jim Baker had become one of those. And so I was in that circle of Jim Baker and Dick Cheney and Jerry Ford. And when I was up for ambassador, I turned it down because I really took the position, me, ambassador, you know, and I turned it down. And I got a call from Rich Bond, who had been the political director in the White House, who wanted to know why I turned the president down. And it was just pretty obvious that I had young kids in high school, and I didn't really want to uproot them and take them over someplace. And the only place I would really like to go would be Italy, because that's where my grandfather had emigrated from. And that was the only place I'd be interested in going. And finally, things came together, and there were 113 people on the list for Embassy Rome. And I was lucky enough to get the nod, and had a tough time getting through the appointment process because of my political activity on the other side of the aisle for the majority party ruling the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. And I took my lumps and ended up getting the appointment, and served, I think, with honor, and received some very high awards. And when I came home, I decided to leave Italy just as my grandfather had. And I spent the night in the farmhouse that he had been born in, and left that farmhouse and carried a small satchel and walked the 17 kilometers to the train station where he had taken a train to Genoa, and then sailed and worked his way through France. And my grandfather, with a fifth-year education, arrived here in the United States speaking four languages, and had experience as a, became a vegetable chef at Leone's in New York, and worked his way up to owning his own restaurant, then a bakery, and then he became his own coffee producer and distributor to, well, in his truck. I mean, wasn't like Gordon Foods, a big operation. It was just a small family-owned, he owned it, and not even family-owned, but that's what he did. And he was a proud man who taught me principles of life and was very strict, and had a big influence on my life. And that's why we have Pietro's restaurant in Grand Rapids, because Pietro was my grandfather. And when he passed away, he said, "Don't ever forget me, Petey." And I looked at him, and I was by his bedside, and I told him I wouldn't. And so I packed up all the boxes and shipped them to Grand Rapids, and they were in my basement for several years until I saw that closed breakfast house out there on 28th Street and bought it and remodeled it and created Pietro's.
One more person you mentioned who's back in the news now because of a new book entitled Heart. Tell us about Dick Cheney.
Well, Dick, I was in the White House one day doing some work for President Ford on the Housing Community Development Act of 1974. There was an argument over whether or not his veto would be sustained. And since I was selling lumber to housing manufacturers, he asked me to come in and call my various manufacturers and get them to support his veto of that bill, because he didn't think it was going to help housing, but it would increase the costs of government. So I was there working when Dick Cheney showed up, and Dick Cheney saw me in a pair of jeans and a flannel shirt, and we immediately became good friends, because he was from Wyoming and liked to hunt and fish and spend a lot of time in the outdoors. And we've been friends ever since. And when Ford lost in 76, Cheney came to our home for a couple of nights, and we talked about his future and his career. And then he went off to Wyoming and decided to run for Congress. And then we went to the 1980 convention, and Dick had lunch. I had lunch with Dick and his wife. My wife hadn't come down yet, because I was there the week earlier with the as a national committee man. And Dick told me he was going to have heart surgery. And then the friendship kept going from that point on. And when we were in Rome, he came over several times to visit. We've spent time with him just recently, traveling over to Italy for a five-day weekend, and visited some of the old restaurants and places we went to when I was ambassador and he was Secretary of Defense. We went down to the Amalfi Coast when he was SecDef, and he flew in a helicopter, and all the leaves that were blown down on the grass blew into the lobby of the hotel. It was a little bit embarrassing, but we had a few laughs over that. And the people who ran the hotel were very understanding, but they were excited to have the vice president there as one of their guests. So we've been there. We've watched he and his family grow up, and his daughter have the grandchildren. And Dick and Lynn are two of my favorite people. I think a lot of them, and I think he was a strong and courageous leader who has principle. So
we're talking to Peter Secchia, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to the legendary Grand Rapids businessman, philanthropist, cheerleader, former U.S. ambassador to Italy, Peter Secchia. Peter, you've watched an amazing rebirth of Grand Rapids. How did it happen?
Well, everybody has a different viewpoint on how that happened, but let me clarify this with your listeners. I don't know that I'm legendary, but thank you for the compliment. I'm a guy who works hard and get up early in the morning to start what I have to do. And when I saw Grand Rapids in 1976, I saw it from an angle that many young people today haven't seen. Jerry Ford was coming home for his election eve parade, and I had been asked to chair that. And I had lined up bands and marching groups and set up all the paraphernalia that had to be set up, and we were coming from Jefferson down Fulton over on Division and down Monroe Mall to the old Amway, the old Pantland Hotel in 1976. And the Secret Service wouldn't let me have the parade. There were too many empty buildings along that parade route. And if you remember, it was only 13 years previous when President Kennedy was shot from a vacant building in Texas. The Secret Service was a bit nervous of that. And Jerry Ford had taken some strong positions on certain issues, and there was a contentious fear, the contentious atmosphere that was feared by the security people that maybe he shouldn't be coming down that parade route. And there were only six stores. I walked this and I counted them. There were only six stores that were open from the Pantland all the way up Monroe Mall to Division, over to Fulton, back up past the One Trick Pony, over to Jefferson. Only six stores that had any semblance of activity during the workday. And all the buildings that were over them, all the space and empty, vacant buildings above them, were in bad shape. So what we did is we gathered the auxiliary police officers groups, the retired police officers groups. We got all the people we could get together to ask them if they would help us welcome Jerry Ford home that night, and if they would wear their uniforms, and were they licensed to carry their weapons, and would they come to classes on what to look for. And they all agreed to do that, so we went back to the Secret Service and told them that we would have a uniformed officer on every floor and every vacant building, and we would have people who would come to class and be trained. And so they agreed to allow us to have that parade. And after we had that parade, I was sitting behind the platform with Rich DeVos and Jay Van Antle, Fred Meyer, Peter Cook, and a few others, and I mentioned to them the problems in pulling this parade off and the loneliness of downtown Grand Rapids and how we had to find a way to make this a vibrant downtown community. And they said to me, let's get together after all this is over, the election's over. Well, Jerry Ford lost the election. I became the chairman of the Kent County Republican Committee. And during those years, I asked Rich DeVos to chair a meeting downtown. He said, well, you put it together and you invite the people, which I did. But I was a sort of an unknown. I was known as a friend of Ford's, but I was really a young Cub salesman at Universal. So I needed to have someone with respect to the community, and so I asked Rich to chair and Rich to speak. So we had a meeting, and all of these community leaders who were then in office, and we've now lost many of them, Fred and Pete and Peter Cook and Fred Meyer, and we've lost others. It's just, you know, things go by. Jay's gone now. But these people came together, and Rich gave the plea, and he and I worked on the content of that speech, and he did a wonderful job, as only Rich can do. And everybody said, well, let's get together and let's do something. And then Jay and Rich led the battle when they moved in to the DeVos Performance Hall over at the Convention Center, which at that time was called DeVos Hall. And then Rich went into the Pantland Hotel, and his argument always was that if you put your name on a project, others will join you if they believe in you and believe in what you believe in, and that will help you do what you've done. And he taught us all that that's the most important way to get people behind public-private partnerships. And there wasn't too much activity in people giving money to commissions, county commissions, city commissions, and or other projects until you started putting your name on different projects and getting others to join up with you and help you in your cause. So from that point on, we started, all of us, buying buildings, invested. Rich and Jay made the biggest investments in the Pantland Hotel, which was turned out to be a $65 million addition, and I built the 1913 room, and I built I put in Tootsie Van Kelly's, and we did our share of helping them, but they were so good and so wonderfully generous that they set a great standard. And then other contractors and builders and developers in downtown Grand Rapids bought a building here and a building there. And we, you know, it doesn't take a lot when you do it a building at a time. A small building that's empty, vacant, it doesn't have a high price on it. You put up awnings, you plant flowers, you clean it out. Then John Wheeler and I bought the Rockford Construction and in Sipsco, we bought the 17 buildings, and Cherry Street Landing, which was all the buildings south of the arena. And we built, which is now the Western Michigan University building, the various Pepino's and the pub that's down there, and restaurants and the Holland Bank, all those buildings and parking lot 5 and parking lot 1 or 2. It just started growing, but it took from 1997 when we bought Cherry Street Landing until today, which is only 15 years later. You've seen the difference. And now when you go all the way down to where we have the downtown market, you see what's going on Ionia Street and all the construction and buildings. Those were all empty in 1997. We took out wheelbarrow loads of pigeon poop, and we worked them one at a time and put up awnings and cleaned up buildings and painted buildings, and then we sold them or released them, or released them with an option to buy. And now I only own one or two of those buildings, and I still rent out, but most of them are now have entrepreneurs and people in them who have their own businesses. And this is why Grand Rapids has become what it's become, because all of these entrepreneurs and small business people made it happen. There weren't too many big companies that came in down here. It was just individuals. I don't even know who the principals are in a lot of them, but you know, if you look at them and you ride around and you see, well, who owns that? Nobody knows. It's just, it's probably the guy in the back room making the sauce or washing the dishes or serving the tables. It's not somebody sitting in a corporate office. It's somebody trying to make a living.
Peter, as our time winds down tonight, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
Well, everything you do in life is measured by how well you perform. And if you perform well, it has to be, there's only one way to do it, and it's putting time in and believing in what you do.
Talk about a modern-day Horatio Alger story, Peter Secchia. Peter, thanks a million. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.